Tony, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks a million, Don. And as always, a lot to talk about. Yeah. And shall we start with the proposed visit? Apparently, it's going to go ahead towards the end of March, 23rd, 24th of March, by President Barack Obama to Argentina.
Yeah, do you think it's there's a symbolic meaning to this visit? Do you think it's intentional? And if it is, I wonder who it's targeting.
Well, it's just impossible to believe that even Barack Obama would be so insensitive as to choose the precise date of the 40th anniversary of the 1976 military coup in Argentina to visit somebody, Mauricio Macri, who's the new president of Argentina, who was elected at the end of last November and took office early in December last year. And it's Mauricio Macri he and his family are associated with the dictatorship because they, you know, they were at the very least neutral and probably quite supportive of the military dictatorship. You know, how can you be neutral about a dictatorship?
Yeah, moving train, that's right.
So,
and he's a political heir to them for sure. I mean, the faction that was represented or manifest in power at that time is the faction that backs him now, including his American sponsors.
Yeah, absolutely. And the clear sign of that is his decision during the week to order the security forces to repress demonstrations of protest against decisions by his government.
And to decide to pay $1 billion in change to the vulture funds on Wall Street.
Yeah, and it might actually work out to several billion, depending how the negotiations go. Mm-hmm. So it's very clear that the Argentinian voters who were seduced by his non-message prior to the November electoral campaign, which was a second round, and he came second on the first ballot of that round of presidential voting, and then managed to win by quite a narrow margin, 2%, on the second presidential round of voting. But he was very, very careful not to give a clear program, and if he'd given the clear program of what he's now implementing, he would not be president of Argentina now. So it's very clear that most people wanted some kind of change because they're in Argentina because they were worried about the economic situation. He lied to them and said that he'd make things better based on a neoliberal austerity agenda, among his first measures was sacking tens of thousands of public workers, as if that's going to improve the Argentinian economy.
Right.
Yeah. And just look at that, the logic of that, which is the same logic that applies in the United States. You know, if you sack people or pay them zero salaries or discourage them to work for more than a year, that's going to benefit the economy.
Right. They're not going to buy anything. They can't afford anything. And if there's any available, they're on relief. So it's an expense to the government, non-productive expense.
Yeah. And so the austerity arguments is many, many, you know, very, very well-respected economists like Dean Baker, you know, even Paul Krugman, those kinds of economists.
Bourgeois.
And they've been arguing that kind of stuff in the States for years, and to no avail. Yeah. And you can see both in the United States and Argentina that the arguments of the neoliberal economists, what Michael Hudson so rightly called them, a very Michael Hudson, of all the economists, saying, along with Dean Baker and people like Steve Keen, the Australian, and a couple of others, very few others, were the ones that predicted the financial crisis of 2007-2008.
Me too, by the way. I did too.
Yeah, right. Don DeBar, right.
I'll tell you something. And my job at the time, I was working at a title insurance agency, the real estate market. And at the end of the year, the firm that I was working at, the man who used to own it, who passed, who had hired me, I knew most of my life, every year would put out a newsletter at the end of the year to send to his clients with prognostications. And I predicted that the real estate market was going to collapse, that there would be no quick comeback this time. It would be unprecedented in terms of how long it would take to clear out, if ever. And my friend who was running the business at the time struck it and wrote something to put under my name that was sort of cheery, happy, thanks for your business instead. But I wrote that in December of 2007.
Right, okay. So and that what that means, Don, is that you are a real economist.
And I can add and subtract. That's all it means. You could look at what was happening. It was obvious even to me.
Yeah, and that's what Dean Baker and Michael Hudson and Steve Keane and all these other guys who predicted the crisis were saying. Look, it's crazy that the junk economists who dominate economic policy making are saying that everything's all right, because it was so obvious there was a massive housing bubble that was going to have a huge impact on the economy of the United States through the end of 2008. And even the guys like Mike Whitney, and who aren't economists, but who have made themselves economists, saying he writes a lot for Counterpunch, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. And people like Mike Whitney were kind of trying to amplify as best they could the diagnosis, or the prognosis, as you put it, of real economists about what was going to happen. Everything that you and people who, you know, the economists like you, who are looking at real things in the real economy in the United States and not listening to the neoliberal propaganda from the phony economy of, and everything that you and those guys were talking about is happening in Argentina. And that Mauricio Macri is imposing the most stupid and really, really stupid from the point of view of the well-being of most people in Argentina, policies, economic policies, that only benefit the tiny elite, of which Mauricio Macri is the paradigmatic representative. And that's what he represents. So the fact that Barack Obama, who has defended Wall Street and protected Wall Street and protected their bonuses and made it possible for the financial sector not only to survive but actually to consolidate their political power over the United States economy, the fact that Barack Obama, that, you know, that has been his role since he was elected in, when was it, 2008?
Yeah, 2008, yeah.
Right, and that has been his role. He has been the Wall Street shill sitting there in the White House pretending to represent the North American people, the people of the United States.
Yep, even before he was elected, actually, because the big thing that he did in September, 2 months before the election of 2008, was when the Congress had voted down the bailout package for the banks, he went around and lobbied the Democrats. This was after, like, the largest outpouring of public sentiment on any issue in the history of the United States, and maybe the world, millions of emails telling Congress not to do it. And they voted it down, and he went out, he strong-armed, because he was soaring in the polls, he strong-armed all these Democrats in Congress to pass it, and it did pass.
Yeah, and what was the name of the Treasury Secretary, Hank Paulson?
Yeah, Paulson, yeah.
And he was trying to push through this $700 billion boondoggle package for his Wall Street mates at Goldman Sachs and all the others. Anyway, and that's, you know, that's all history. But what's happening now is kind of in Argentina, that Barack Obama is fulfilling the same role. And he's going to turn up on the first 40th anniversary of the military coup that destroyed Argentina's economy, because that's what the military coup, it not only amounted to an assault by the Argentina's corporate elite, of which Mauricio Macri and his family were a part, They presented themselves as being neutral and, oh, it's something that we don't have any control over. They very much supported the military coup in Argentina.
They cashed the checks, right? They got checks, they cashed the checks, yeah.
Well, yeah, and of course, remember, 1976, who was then in power? And it was Henry Kissinger still, mm-hmm. Wasn't it? And Gerald Ford, was it not?
Yes, that's right.
In 1976?
Yep.
And so you had the same shills for the U.S. corporate elites that had kind of sustained the Vietnam War, and then they lost Vietnam, and they were determined. You remember Che Guevara saying, "What we need in Latin America is one too many Vietnams," and Henry Kissinger, and as the representative of the foreign policy formulation of the United States, North American, and also their European colleagues, corporate elites, were determined that they would not lose Latin America. That's how they put it.
Yep.
We can't afford to lose Latin America, as though Latin America somehow belonged to the U.S. corporate elite. Mm-hmm. And so what they did was they very, very deliberately supported the coup in Chile, mm-hmm. in 1973. Mm-hmm. And then 3 years later, they absolutely firmly supported the military dictatorship in Argentina at the same time as people like Gene Kirkpatrick, for example, who and those politicians from Republican politicians from that era were talking about how the mission of the United States is to spread liberty and democracy around the world. You know, and just such gross hypocrisy, the same kind of gross hypocrisy that we're seeing at the moment, by which the United States government and its NATO allies is supporting terrorist forces against the Syrian government. Mm-hmm. You know, and just so in 1976, the version of what now we're seeing as the support for terrorist activity against legitimately elected governments in Syria, Argentina, and elsewhere. And in those days, it was absolutely explicit. The United States government supported the military coup in Argentina, and they dressed it up as kind of, well, we don't have any control over events in Argentina, but of course they very much supported that coup. And if you read historical documents about the exchanges between U.S. diplomats and their counterparts in the rest of the region, and it's very clear that that the United States supported the coup. And what happened in the coup? What happened in the coup was that, and we can use the word fascist without putting any inverted commas around it,
right.
In terms of the 1976 coup, because the military, the senior military officers that engineered that coup in Argentina were very, very explicitly right-wing, committed to the most right-wing fascist policies, a close alliance with the corporate sector in Argentina for the national good. That's how they projected it. We had to do this coup in order to protect national well-being and promote the prosperity of the Argentinian people against socialist ideas that were going to destroy both the Argentina's economy and its society. That was their argument. And Mauricio Macri, who's now the president of Argentina, and his family were very much part of that agenda. So, and what happened during the coup from 1986 to 1983, 7 years, 30,000 people were disappeared. No, mostly from the middle classes, but also from working class people in the organized labor movement. But the most people were middle class people who supported even social democrat ideas, never mind communist ideas. And what happened to those people? They were viciously tortured. And one of the interesting things is that you have testimony from Jewish survivors, survivors of Jewish origin, that they were tortured under portraits of Adolf Hitler.
The ideology is, lifted right out of Nazi Germany.
Right. And so, for what are we going to see on March the 23rd, March 24th, when Barack Obama visits Argentina? We're going to see the crocodile tears. We're going to see the classic Barack Obama hypocrisy, for which he will go down in history as the, you know, the U.S. president who is most blatant in his, the hypocrisy of his public declarations, because he's going to go to Argentina and he's going to shed crocodile tears about U.S. support for the Argentinian military coup that destroyed Argentina through 7 years. And what happened after that? Why is in 1999, 2000, 2001 was Argentina in crisis? It was in crisis because, largely because, during the military coup, the military regime indebted itself to Wall Street to the tune of something like $40 billion. And as Michael Hudson, this exceptional economist that the United States is lucky enough to have but doesn't listen to, has pointed out, the key thing about once you get into debt in the capitalist financial system, you are then subject to the magic of compound interest. And so those $40 million over the years turned into the massive debt that Argentina couldn't afford to pay at the end of 1999, 2000, 2001. And so I know that what's happening in Argentina now is that after 8, 10, 12 years of very sound public administration under the Social Democrat governments of Nestor Kirchner and Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, Nestor Kirchner's widow, and Argentina recovered. And because as a result of the collapse in international commodity prices, the Argentinian economy found itself in the doldrums. And Mauricio Macri took advantage of that to say, well, we can do better. The right wing is somehow magically going to make everything better and bring prosperity to Argentina in 2016. You know, how cynical can you get? I mean, they're going to do the exact opposite. They're going to inflict the same kind of misery on the majority of ordinary people in Argentina that Barack Obama and his team, his Goldman Sachs team, have inflicted on the people of the United States.
Yeah, they're cutting the check again, right? I mean, they're getting ready to cut the check.
Right. So, I feel very bitter. I feel very strongly about the sheer hypocrisy of Barack Obama as the inheritor of Henry Kissinger's. You know, he's the inheritor of Henry Kissinger's foreign policy from the 1970s. You know, and there's very little change in what they're doing. And he's going to go to Argentina and give his stamp of approval to a government that is attacking the majority of the Argentinian people in the same way that his government has attacked the majority of people in the United States.
So, well, he's going to be standing with the heir to that coup. And he's not going to be standing with the heir of, to the people that fought the coup, which is, of course, in the National Assembly.
Sure. Well, it'll be very interesting to see who he meets.
The Congress.
Will he meet the Madres de la Plaza de Mayo? And the Madres de la Plaza de Mayo are a group of truly heroic women who, during decades, have been campaigning to try and find out what happened to the children and the grandchildren of the people who had disappeared through the dirty war in Argentina for 7 years, and just to give an idea of how dirty the war was in moral terms, what the interrogators used to do was they'd torture their victims and then get them to sign documents signing over their property to the torturers. And that is what led, for example, to the case of the notorious case of Ricardo Carvalho, who some years ago, he was one of the Argentinian torturers, and he made himself rich by extorting under torture from his victims documents that gave him and his fellow torturers power over the property and goods of the people they were torturing. Amazing. And subsequently, he moved to Mexico. He moved to El Salvador and started up a business there, where he became the main contractor to the Salvadoran government under the right-wing Arena government for issuing driving licenses in El Salvador. And then he did very well there, and then he moved on to Mexico, and he did exactly the same thing there in Mexico under the administration of the right wing of Vicente Fox.
How come everybody in their driver's license picture has a black eye and lumps on their head?
Well, we can make that kind of black humor if we like, but I'm sorry. So then ultimately, finally, the Spanish judicial authorities, because of Carvalho's involvement in the murder and torture of some Spanish citizens during the 76-83 military dictatorship, extradited him to Spain, and he's now serving time in Spain, as far as I'm aware, for his crimes. But he's one of the few. He's one of the very few Argentinian torturers that got away with their horrible crimes against humanity, who's actually paid a judicial penalty and is actually serving time. Because most of those guys have benefited from the difficulty in Argentina of trying to come to terms with that dreadful past.
For sure. They're part of the resistance to that, too, of course. And some of them, I'm sure, if they're not holding office directly, you know, people that are holding office are there because of their patronage.
Right.
Because they didn't take their money away from them.
And now, of course, they're protected by Mauricio Macri and his colleagues, many of whom are very closely associated with the United States government administration of Barack Obama.
Hey, about Obama, by the way, and that meeting, just for context, I'm hoping that there isn't a small group of people that come out of the survivors that decides to sit down with him and, you know, for photo ops or whatever, because Obama has been masterful at that. He just had to sit down with people from the Black Lives Movement, for example. One person notably declined and made a public statement about why, but there were people that'll sit down, you know, for the star value or whatever, and it'll look like, yeah, he had that meeting with them.
Oh, yeah, and you can bet that there'll be those photo ops, and that they'll be widely broadcast and in the North American and European media, you know, and Barack Obama, the great reconciler, the great unifier. And how cynical can you get?
Right, because there won't be any restorative justice done as a consequence,
of course,
which is
not
the demand that they have.
And justice is the last thing that Barack Obama is ever going to stand up for.
That's right.
So then, no, I feel passionately about that. But anyway, so then the other date on his tour of Latin America is going to be a meeting in Havana, and he'll be meeting with the Cuban government there on the 21st and the 22nd of March, and presumably they'll be talking about how to advance the reconciliation and the rapprochement between the Cuban authorities and the United States authorities. But the nitty gritty there is, will he announce an end to the blockade? Mm-hmm. And will he announce a government initiative by the United States government to end the blockade? Because if he doesn't, it's just nonsense. And they've already done, the Cubans and the Cuban authorities and the U.S. authorities have already negotiated a bunch of stuff around kind of minor regulations to do with trade, to do with direct flights and
travel.
So, yeah, travel, stuff like that, tourism. But the nitty-gritty is, will the United States government lift its commercial and financial sanctions against the Cuban government, which have been quite illegal for 50 years? Under any interpretation of currently extant international law, what the United States policy has been against Cuba in commercial and financial terms has been completely illegal.
Yeah, especially the third-party sanctions. The U.S. essentially interjected itself into relationships between other countries in Cuba. There are cracks in that formulating, but that there are cracks.
Even the European Union, you know, this. What is the European Union? It's a kind of supine, you know, please walk over me partner to the United States. And they, even they are saying, you know, it's time for a change on Cuba. Mm-hmm. You know, and so if even those unconditional U.S. allies are saying, yeah, things have got to change. And will things change? I mean, who knows? I mean, the United States government and the corporate elites that back it and the right-wing interests to which Barack Obama is hostage, despite being a Democrat president.
Well, we're only talking about changing tactics anyway. It's not just tactical in terms of impact on Cuba's economy, of course. But for the U.S., it's just a matter of tactics. They still want to own and control Cuba. It's just, and Latin America in general. Will we accomplish it better this way or that is what they're debating.
Yeah. And, so it seems to me that it's possible but unlikely that on March the 21st and 22nd, Barack Obama will say, right, we're going to ask Congress to lift the blockade.
And then there's problem.
Yeah, man, because I think you're right, Don. I think that United States policy in Cuba is let's open up just enough to enable us to get some levers into the Cuban social and economic system, and then we'll apply as much pressure as we can on those levers to open it up and break up cracks in the Cuban revolution. And that's it seems to me very clear that that's what they're trying to do. And so, from that point of view, lifting the blockade doesn't make sense.
And then, of course, the Republican Congress, there's plenty of Democrats, too, like Menendez, by the way, but the Republican Congress may be running along with their standard bearer, and it may be Mark Rubio, who is completely and totally opposed to any opening up with Cuba.
And so many people, even Noam Chomsky and people with whom I disagree a lot about stuff internationally, and even they are very clear that it's a one-party system in the United States with two different wings. And so, I doubt very much, and it's possible, but I doubt very much that Obama will announce an end to the blockade when he visits Cuba towards the end of March. So then what else is happening? We got Bolivia, haven't we?
Yeah, the big vote today, Sunday.
Yeah, and there's a big vote today about the Bolivian constitution has a provision whereby there's a limit on how many times a sitting president can run for office. And this is... it's become very much a theme, hasn't it, in certainly in Latin America, because so many leaders like Rafael Correa, Daniel Ortega, before his tragic death, Comandante Hugo Chavez, people like Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, it's very likely that if she'd been the candidate in Argentina last November, she would have won on the first round.
For sure. Yeah.
And now you have this situation in Bolivia where the massive advances that Evo Morales and his political party and his governmental colleagues have achieved on behalf of the Bolivian people, it's not clear how sustainable they'd be with an administration under a different person. And so in Bolivia they were debating for a couple of years, really, at least 18 months and more like a couple of years, is how to manage the sustainability and the continuity of the Bolivian revolution, because that's what it's been since Evo Morales, certainly since the new constitution was voted in. Was that in 2008? I now forget. Yeah. But I mean, there was
around then.
There was a grassroots, a massive grassroots consultative process, including the opposition, and it was a very conflictive and contentious process back in 2006, 2007, 2008, around the same time that a similar process was happening in Ecuador. There were constituent assemblies in Ecuador and Bolivia that analyzed, you know, how can we define and constitute a new political constitution for our countries that meets our needs in the 21st century. That's what the whole argument was about. Right. And in Ecuador, Rafael Correa and his people who thought like him won the day, and they pushed through a new constitution for Ecuador. And in a very similar but even more contentious process in Bolivia, and a new constitution was developed. But that new constitution put term limits on the number of times a sitting president could present themselves again for re-election. And so today, February the 21st, in Bolivia, there's this very, very important referendum in which the Bolivian people will decide whether they want Evo Morales to be able to stand for the presidency in 2019.
Yeah.
And so, no, and let's see what happens. I mean, in my opinion, this is a very, very important kind of, I don't know if litmus test is the right word, but it's a very important test for which way grassroots opinion is moving in Latin America overall. Because in Argentina, you had a kind of false test.
Right.
In the Argentinian elections, and in Venezuela you have an even more distorted test,
right,
because of the massive intervention by the United States and its allies against the legitimately elected Venezuelan authorities. So,
and against when the economy too.
Yeah, so when commentators say, oh well, look, and there's this move to the right in Latin America, what they're talking about is an extremely manipulated, a cynically manipulated set of political processes in Argentina and Venezuela, whereby the right wing, with massive support from the United States government and the most reactionary elements in both Argentina's and Venezuela's societies, have taken advantage of an international economic downturn in order to deceive ordinary people into voting for them. And that's what's happened in both Argentina and in Venezuela.
That's right.
And so what you've got in Bolivia is actually a much purer process. You've got a much purer, a much cleaner, much fairer, much more free democratic vote, in which people at grassroots in Bolivia will decide, you know, are we going to provide continuity and sustainability to this political process, it is a socialist political process,
yep,
despite what all the criticisms that, you know, left-wingers may outside Bolivia and outside Latin America may make of Evo Morales. It is fundamentally a socialist process that is taking place in Bolivia. And so if Evo Morales wins this vote, as we expect him to do, with well over 60% of the vote, and that'll be a crushing answer to the phony commentators that are talking about a shift to the right in Latin America.
Yeah.
So let's see what happens today.
Yeah, I'm watching, definitely. Okay, what else? We want to move on to... we're going to talk about in Venezuela, for example, the emergency economic measures.
Yeah, you may be more on top of this than me, Don, but I mean, the big thing in Venezuela, the announcements that... And was it last week we were talking about the ruling by the Supreme Court that the emergency economic measures that President Nicolas Maduro's government has instituted are legal and have legal validity because they were challenged by the National Assembly. And did we discuss that last week?
Yeah, we did, because that had happened in the previous week. You know, the test and the decision, I think, came down on that Friday.
Yeah, okay. So then in the wake of that decision, what Nicolas Maduro was able to do is he's able to, in the wake of that decision by the Venezuelan Supreme Court that validated his power to engage in economic emergency measures that were being challenged by the right-wing dominated National Assembly in this supposed dictatorship, right? And that's what the right-wing press in, that's what the corporate media in the United States and Europe, they try and say that Nicolas Maduro is a dictator. Yeah, right. And then now they've got this right-wing dominated National Assembly, the corporate media in North America and Europe are kind of, they're perplexed about how to present it all. Because there's been, that was such a profound demonstration of the true democracy that exists in Venezuela, in such sharp contrast to the phony democratic systems in the United States and Western Europe. Anyway, that's another story.
Well, look, so, they said it about Chavez also, and they pulled him out of power until the people restored him to power, and it was kind of a hard sell after that, that he was a dictator.
Right. Well, and they still did, despite all the evidence to the contrary.
That's true.
So, but it's much more difficult. Now they've actually got a right-wing dominated Congress that's trying to implement the agenda that the Western European and North American governments want to have implemented. And they're finding that they're actually having to deal with real democratic institutions and not the phony democratic institutions that exist in North America and Western Europe. So anyway, and that's... So what's happening, I know over the last week, what Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues announced were a series of economic measures. The two most important that I picked up on, you may have picked up on others, Don, but the most important that I picked up on were a 6,000% increase in the price of gasoline. In the price of fuel, diesel and gasoline fuel. And also... The second thing that I picked up on was it a 20% increase in the minimum wage? It might have been a 30%.
It was a good chunk.
A very significant increase in the minimum wage. Now,
gasoline was only a penny a gallon before it was heavily subsidized, and now it's $6 a gallon.
And so it's really important to explain that to people, because one of the fundamental weaknesses of the Venezuela's economy ever since Hugo Chavez took power in 1998 was that the previous governments, the right-wing governments, that had the so-called Fourth Republic governments in Venezuela, had maintained a policy of super cheap diesel and gasoline fuel for people. And that in itself, and the Hugo Chavez inherited that policy, and one of the things that's a mystery to people is why it has taken so long for that supremely rational decision, you know. And how can you possibly maintain a price differential in Venezuela of, you know, pennies on the dollar for diesel and gasoline fuel, when you are actually faced with a massive smuggling problem into Colombia, where gas prices and diesel prices are kind of several thousand percent higher?
Right. I just fill up a truck in Venezuela and drive it across the border, and I make a boatload of money.
Yeah, and it's not just that economic disadvantage. It also creates the whole social and legal and criminal problem of smuggling involving public officials who are offered huge amounts of money. You know, let me drive this tanker through, and I'll give you $10,000.
Right. Yeah. Yep. And you also have a class subsidy. You have a class subsidy going on too, because you know, it's not a car culture like the United States. Across the country, it's not anyway. In the urban areas, some, but you know, the bulk of the revenue is going to be going to the poorest people in Venezuela, and the bulk of the revenue is going to be extracted from the middle class and the wealthy, and from commerce.
Okay. So. And that's just another example of the kind of multifaceted problems that crazy policy of maintaining super low gasoline and diesel prices created for the Venezuelan economy. And it was just something that the Venezuelan authorities under Comandante Hugo Chavez and under President Nicolas Maduro have been trying to grapple with for the last 10, 12, 15 years.
You know, what's interesting, and there's also a symmetry because the Saudis are forced to do something similar, by the way. They've started taxing petrol in Saudi Arabia.
Well, that'll be interesting because, I mean, the Saudi Arabians have kind of been totally privileged and protected from that kind of measure for how many decades now? And again, that's another story. So, this move by Nicolas Maduro, increasing gas and diesel prices by 6,000%, but at the same time protecting the lowest paid by increasing the minimum wage by 20 or 30%. I've forgotten what the exact figure is, and that should it. It's by no means a total solution to the underlying problems in Venezuela's economy, but it's very definitely a move in the right direction towards a more rational pricing of resources and a more rational protection for ordinary people. And it's I was quite impressed that Nicolas Maduro had the courage to push those measures through. And I think, do you remember we were talking about this in earlier conversations, Don? When, after the surprise of the advantage that the right wing won in Venezuela's National Assembly elections, I think you and I both said that it may well now be possible in this new context for Nicolas Maduro to introduce measures, political measures, that would have been very difficult for him to introduce before the National Assembly became came under the control of the right wing.
Yep.
And I think this is an example of it. And I think that Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues, Diosdado Cabello and all their ministerial colleagues, they understand very clearly that if they don't push hard now to get the Venezuelan economy into some kind of more rational equilibrium than was possible in the past, then they're likely to find that later in the year, the economy is going to be even in even worse shape than it would otherwise be.
Yep.
And so that, and I think they're taking kind of preventive, kind of, what's the word? I mean, preventive measures that will protect their ability to defend ordinary people in ordinary people's living standards in the Venezuelan economy. And I think they've been very astute in trying to manage that.
There's another element, by the way, that goes with that in the emergency measures. There's another element along those lines. You know, one of the big problems was the private ownership of the distribution network, where they were holding back goods from the market, causing inflation and distortion and shortages and all of that. And one of the things that he decreed was the seizure of the large supermarkets, and he's handing them over to the community groups to run.
At last.
Yeah.
And at long last, I mean, people have been arguing for that for well over a year now.
Yep.
And there was, I don't know if you remember, but I know, I think it was a couple of years ago, there were, and not long after Nicolas Maduro was elected by a very narrow margin in the presidential elections following the death of Comandante Hugo Chavez. He soon after those elections, he tried to engage in the same kind of dialogue that Daniel Ortega here in Nicaragua has been able to engage the right-wing business community here in Nicaragua. And Nicolas Maduro tried to do something quite similar in Venezuela shortly after he was elected president following Hugo Chavez's death. And he was in talks with the head of the massive corporate grocery conglomerate, among many other things, Polar. I've forgotten the name of the guy, but a very similar guy to Mauricio Macri in terms of profile, and in terms of his corporate business profile. And although that this individual was not an overt politician. He was very much part of the corporate political elite, the fascist elite, the marriage of political power and corporate power in Venezuela. And they just laughed at Maduro. And it was, I felt really, indignant and sad that Nicolas Maduro's best efforts to try and reach out to the right-wing opposition for the good of the Venezuelan people, even sacrificing his political ideological positions, were just treated with contempt by the fascist right-wing opposition because they were determined to destroy Maduro and destroy the Bolivarian socialism in Venezuela. And now, finally, he recognized that at the time and realized that within the political context of the time, it was impossible for him to instigate the measures that he's now finally able to implement. And so, and it's a crucial political moment in Venezuela. And will the Bolivarian socialist policies of Nicolas Maduro be able to defeat the vicious economic sabotage of the fascist corporate political elite in Venezuela? And we'll find out over the next 3 to 4 months.
That's right. Yeah, and that's exactly how I would characterize it, too. That's exactly what's going on.
Right. So then I'm here in Nicaragua, and Nicaragua tends to fall in and out of the news, very much to do with any news that may come into the purview of the corporate media to do with the canal, right? Because that's the big thing here in Nicaragua for the moment, the Interoceanic Canal, and that seems, and that whenever there's good news, and that gets buried by the corporate media. And so I know over the last week or so, there's been news about how the canal project is progressing and how it's more or less on schedule. And during the year, work should begin on the big deep water port that on the Pacific coast that will facilitate the arrival of the massive machinery that's necessary to excavate the canal. That machinery is being provided by major Chinese corporations. And so, but of course that all gets buried and they wait until there's some negative news to report about the canal, like, oh, well, look at China's economic problems, and that means that the Chinese entrepreneur promoting the canal is not going to be able to carry through his ideas, and the project's going to collapse and all that nonsense. And the canal project is the fundamental thing to understand about the canal project in Nicaragua is that it is a strategic project, not just for Nicaragua but for the region in Central America and for the Chinese government.
And economy. I mean, but behind the guy with the checkbook for the canal project stands the entire Chinese economy. So yeah. Even if there's a balking by this particular set of investors or whatever, it's Chinese national policy to help Latin America and the Caribbean develop and make them customers.
Right. So I just thought it was worth mentioning that because there have been a couple of news items in the local Nicaraguan media about how the canal's progressing, but you never read anything about that in the corporate media. The only thing you read in the corporate media in North America and Europe is whenever there's bad news that might affect the canal. So then, and the other big thing today, is a very significant day here in Nicaragua because it's the anniversary of the 82nd anniversary of the murder by the Nicaraguan authorities at the instigation of the United States Embassy in 1934 of General Augusto Sandino, who is one of Nicaragua's national heroes. And this is a big year for Nicaragua in terms of It's the centenary of, and as we've mentioned in past programs, it's the centenary of the passing of Nicaragua's national poet Rubén Darío, who is also, he's regarded as the founder of modernism in Hispanic literature, and regarded as, you know, in literary terms, as a revolutionary who transformed Spanish literature.
Even in Spain.
Even in Spain. And so, because, and maybe the history of this is quite interesting. And in 1898, of course, the United States defeated Spain. It defeated Spain in Cuba, defeated Spain in the Philippines. Right. And that's, you know, that the United States government then instigated its policy of imperialism and colonialism far beyond U.S. borders. That it had already kind of committed massive genocide against Native Indian populations in the United States, and it carried the 1890s were the year that it really carried that policy far out into distant seas and shores, and first to Cuba and then to the Philippines, defeating the Spanish Empire in those places and taking over the Spanish imperial mantle in those places.
That's right.
In under different forms. And so for Spain, and if you look at it from the point of view of the defeated, from the point of view of the Spanish, and that was a really deep trauma. And Rubén Darío was a Spanish writer who was a witness to that tremendous traumatic kind of epoch-making defeat for the Spanish Empire. And he wrote very sympathetically about it. His main publications on around that theme were in Argentinian media, in particular La Nación, the kind of standard bearer of Argentinian journalism through much of the 20th century. And he developed that whole essay kind of approach to dealing with larger themes and not just reporting on specific events. So that in itself was a very important development in Spanish literature and Spanish journalism, and the way events and trends and processes are reported in Spanish news media. And it was, so Rubén Darío, he wasn't just a crucially important literary poet, he was also a great Spanish language journalist, bridging Spain and Latin America. So and that's one of the reasons why people who are outside Spanish literature and outside Spanish language find it so puzzling that Rubén Darío is so highly regarded. But and it's one of the components that make up the massive achievement of Rubén Darío in terms of development of the Spanish language and Spanish literature. Mm. So and this today's anniversary of the murder of Augusto Sandino is very much part of Nicaragua's national consciousness and national identity, because Sandino in so many ways was a political embodiment of the same kind of achievements that Rubén Darío made in the literary sphere. And he challenged the most powerful empire in the world at the time, certainly in the Western Hemisphere. And some people now argue that the British and French empires were more powerful than the United States Empire in the 1930s. But in terms, in Latin American terms, Augusto Sandino led a guerrilla war against the most powerful hemispheric power, and was not defeated, which means that he won. Which means
that
he won.
That's right.
Yeah, and because that's the essence of guerrilla war. If you're not defeated, you win. Right.
That's the game.
So, and what was the United States' response to that? And if you read kind of U.S. official accounts of the death of Sandino, they'll bend over backwards to try and pretend that the United States Embassy was not involved in that murder, which is just a disgusting, cowardly, a massively deceitful betrayal. And instigated by the United States ambassador at the time. And if you want testimony about, you know, okay, I mean, people in the United States will say, okay, so what proof have you got that the United States Embassy was involved in that? And the proof is this. And I was fortunate enough to work very closely with Walter Castillo Sandino, who's the Sandino's grandson, and has done a lot of documentation and research into what happened to his father around the time, his grandfather around the time of Sandino's death, and also into his wider achievements. But specifically in relation to Sandino's death, what Walter Sandino has found out is that there's testimony by a guy, I think it's his Rolando Murillo, who's some kind of relation to Rosario Murillo, Daniel Ortega's wife, who herself is a member of Sandino. She has some family relationship to Augusto Sandino. And Rolando Murillo's testimony is that he was having supper with people who were in Sandino's circle, and that they, during that supper, they were attacked by members of the National Guard, which is run
Somoza's by National Guard, right?
The United States proxy Anastasio Somoza at the time, right. And everybody in the room was murdered, and he was lying on the floor, severely wounded, and the U.S. ambassador Arthur Bliss Lane, whom Rolando Murillo knew, came to see what had happened at that event. And Rolando Murillo's testimony is that he gave this testimony. He survived, and he was taken to hospital but died about 9 days later. But he gave this testimony, apparently. And his testimony was that Arthur Bliss Lane witnessed the scene, saw that Rolando Murillo was still alive, spoke to a National Guard soldier, telling him to finish Rolando Murillo off. And the soldier didn't. And so that is why Walter Castillo Sandino believes that the United States Embassy was deeply implicated in the murder of, you know, that's the proof. And because the U.S. authorities, even in those days, what are we talking about? We're talking about 80, 90 years ago. Even in those days, they looked for deniability.
Franklin Roosevelt was president then.
Yeah, you know, the buen vecino, the good neighbor,
yeah.
Ha ha.
Yeah, right.
You know, so and that's why Nicaraguans feel so deeply about the death of Sandino, and why for them it's so symbolic about the cynical deceit of the United States government. It's really important that people in the U.S. understand that while even ordinary people, and also, but also the political classes, the kind of Sandinistas in Nicaragua, they draw a very clear line between the cynicism, their view of the cynicism of the U.S. government, and their view of the nobility of the United States people, which is embodied in, for example, in the death of Benjamin Linda, and this wonderful guy who came down, and he was killed, I think it was 1987. He was an engineer, he was a water engineer. Oh, no, he wasn't. He was an electrical engineer. And he was working on a mini hydroelectric project when he was killed by Contra terrorists funded by Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, that's our history.
And so, there's all those kinds of subtleties and modulations to the relations between Nicaragua and the United States. But today's anniversary is a very important day for people in Nicaragua.
Okay, and we got to leave it there, Tony. Thanks a lot. Pleasure as always.
Okay, thanks, Don.
Thanks.